ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The Art Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Sky Kirkham, and today I'm bringing you some of my favourite conversations from the show and highlighting some of the great exhibitions you'll be able to check out over the summer months. Later this hour, you'll meet the Icelandic artist Ólafur Elíasson, who documented the glaciers of his homeland and found himself shocked by what he saw, or didn't see, after 20 years of climate change. And Mike Hewson, whose latest exhibition features a sauna, a public barbecue, and a playground, will explain how he came to combine public art with play and became comfortable with the public climbing all over his work. But we begin with the artist Nell, who has not one but two major works on at the moment, a 30-year survey at the Heidi Gallery in Melbourne and a big new public art in collaboration with Tony Albert at Goma in Brisbane. Last year, Ramesh Marionithyendran sat down with Nell to explore how collaboration and a love for material have shaped her practice.
Lightning bolts, rock music processions, guitars, giant emojis, and friendly ghosts are all part of a complex visual language synonymous with the artist Nell. Throughout her 30-year practice, she has mastered and manoeuvred painting, ceramics, textiles, video, sculpture, and performance to explore the universality of our finite human existence. Hi, Nell. Welcome to the studio.
Hi, Ramesh.
I have been so excited to talk to you about your work, your philosophy, your life, your views, your approach, everything that you've been making recently. But I wanted to take you down a little trip down memory lane. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Are you ready? Okay, well, that's good. So I remember one of the first times I exhibited alongside of you. It was at the 2016 Adelaide Biennial of Australian Art, and you presented an installation called The Wake. And as I approached the materials list, this is what I encountered. Stoneware clay, earthenware clay, concrete, bronze, glass, underglaze, glaze, polyurethane, varnish, acrylic paint, enamel paint, spray paint, fabric paint, pigment, varnish, oxide, boncrete, decals, silver leaf, gold leaf, copper, glitter, wood, branches. So these are all the materials in one work or one installation. Very simple question. Why so many materials, Nell?
Okay, well, I think you've outed me as a material girl. I love materials and what they can communicate. And some of the list of that materials that you just read in that installation also included found objects and works that I made with my own hands and transformed, materially transformed, like through the clay, through the concrete, and then also combined with natural materials like the branches or there was eel skins in that work too and other natural items. So that's where the magic is for me, when those materials all combine together. And I think humans have been doing this since time immemorial, transforming materials, finding things and putting them together.
The other thing that I saw, Nell, was when I was looking at the work listing in the Art Gallery of South Australia's website, they omitted something that was initially there. And I remember seeing cobwebs in
That's
the materials
right.
list in the original installation. Talk to me, why is it important for you to I guess, describe every single material that's in a work?
The materiality of the cobwebs and the cobwebs that had formed under that stool, it was very much as is. And it's about acceptance, actually, a lot of it, and to accept that something's dirty, something's not perfect. And we try and sweep those things away, and I want to collapse the value of something like a gold leaf in that work, which our society tells us is valuable, with the cobweb, because they're just as beautiful if you take time to look at them. And that's what I've been doing in a lot of other symbols in my work, like blowflies. They might be ugly and dismissible, but they're kind of beautiful if you take the time to look at the bottle green colour and the opalescence of the wings. So much of my work, which not many people have ever touched on, is that collapse of value.
I almost see it as more of a flattening rather than a collapse. It's like, rather than you saying, these values are really these materials are really valuable and important. You're saying all materials are valuable and important. They all carry stories. They all carry meaning. They all carry this kind of communicative potential. And something that I've heard you say in an interview is all my life is a practice.
Mm.
Talk to me about this penetration between your art and your life.
Well, it's definitely come about through my Buddhist schooling. But also, I think all beings experience this. We just forget. And so much of my work is about trying to get back to the simplicity that cuts through the tirade of mental thought. And a lot of that those materials are trying to externalize and ground that endless and relentless mental association into something that reflects back at us that might thwart that tirade.
It's really interesting because if we think about very preconceived ideas about art and artists, people often associate artists with expertise of a certain material. And you're kind of saying, my material is life.
Mm.
And I look back to The Wake, which we alluded to before in our previous question about all 600 materials you used in that installation. And with that work, there was a real meditation upon life and death.
Mm.
Talk to me about death. Mm. It's almost like death is this generative theme in your studio.
Mm. Well, that body of work, The Wake, when you looked at it, was 41 characters looking at you, and you could have been the subject of The Wake. So much about what we... The last question was about making art and life indivisible. It's making life and death indivisible. And that, again, through my Buddhist studies, that to try and find ways to be intimate with death every day. So going to sleep is a death. Saying goodbye to a friend is a death. But it's about surrender and it's hard to put into words.
For me, when I look at the work, it's almost like there's conscious understanding of mortality the whole time. You're presenting a major work titled Nell and Quilt, and I understand that this landmark work involved about 400 collaborators.
Mm-hmm.
How was this work made?
Mm. Well, again, it's just harnessing all the energy that's around me. So the genesis of this work was that I am a big fan of a New Zealand modernist artist called Colin McCann. And I wanted to shine more of a light on his wife, Anne Hamlett, who is also an artist in her own right. And I started to think about women's creativity and labour, and that she had to be incredibly resourceful while giving in her domestic context, giving up her creative life but being creative in a domestic setting. And so this quilt, I invited any person to submit a patch embroidered with the name of any woman that's had meaning to them in their life to be stitched together into these two big quilts. And what was really the seed that started this project was that I had read a news article in 2016 that said that only 17% of biographies on Wikipedia were on women. I think that's risen to 19% now. And that how we need to tell more stories about women in the world, and not just trailblazing, famous, incredible women, but ordinary legends like my nan or, you know, your neighbour, your cousin, and how these stories, people might sit around, embroider the name, and then they'd all come together in this collective female chorus of story.
Now, that is such a generous approach to making an artwork. You're inviting people in, you're collaborating. And, you know, when I think about my authorship as an artist, I don't want anyone making my work. Talk to me about this process of inviting others in intimately into your making process. How does that feel? What are the anxieties, but also what are the things that are inspirational and generative from that?
I mean, I think if I was a musician, you'd call me a multi-instrumentalist. So, like, I love to fly solo and make things in my own studio. I love to sit side by side by artists, like you and I have sat side by side, we're making our own thing. And then inviting people in is just, it's a reminder that we're not alone, which is going back to that death question, and that we all are searching for some kind of meaning and connection. And it's a great gift. It's a gift cycle, and you enter into that gift cycle and share the space. And then it's not about you anymore. It's about every woman's story. And that's what the quilt's about, where individual stories intertwine with collective stories, particularly female stories.
I'm really interested in this idea of receiving the patches and the experience of receiving the patches. Paint me a picture. I imagine it was a bit like Christmas. You know, the mail would come and you'd like squeeze the envelope and be like, oh, yes, there's a patch in there. Talk to me about some of these memories.
It was like Christmas every day. I cried sometimes. I audibly gasped at the beauty, the way some of them were wrapped. Some of them were just shoved in an envelope with no note. Some of them were just, wrapped like impeccably. People wrote notes with it saying, I'm sorry, my stitching isn't very good. I've got Parkinson's. But every single patch was beautiful. That was the biggest gift of all. And some of them were just so funny. One that comes to mind right now is Auntie Juanita. A group of New Zealand women decided that Santa Claus was too patriarchal, and they made up Auntie Juanita, who had style, wisdom, and was generous, and she was chic, and she bought Christmas presents every year. So this cohort of young people grew up with Auntie Juanita, and that these patches were made in honour of their mothers who made up this character, that even we need more fictional female characters to aspire to. The endless resourcefulness of female stories was just so heart-expanding.
Now, that is such an amazing thing to recount. You know, as artists, we often present our works on the wall, in the museum, and it's like the process has just been put through a washing machine. And I don't mean that in a disparaging way. It's just that sometimes it is the process of making, it's the engagement with others that really textures those artworks and gives it feeling. And what I'm hearing from you is that you're saying when you opened up these envelopes and you looked at these patches, you could feel the feelings, you could feel the emotions. Do you think that had a lasting impact on how you might continue to make work, this kind of experience and an intimate encounter with at least 411 other people?
Well, it's interesting because not only was there the love of the person who'd stitched it, it's the story of the woman it was about. So it was almost doubled. And I felt such a huge responsibility to honour these patches and stories. But going forward, I've already had people saying, can you make another project? We want to come and sew. We want to be involved. And so that's beautiful in and of itself. But because my work is ever evolving into different shows and scales and materials, every project I take something from one project into a next. And where the quilt came from is partially what I learnt from doing workshops making the public artwork of the Everly Treehouse and hand forging the leaves, where people came, over 400 people came and made a leaf. So yeah, it's interesting that blacksmithing segued into hand stitching.
This almost, what is somewhat this decentering of your own hand and this invitation of others, I see a parallel with the way in which a lot of your artwork sometimes establishes a reverence to other artists, you know? So it's creating this dialogue with artists that have come before you and inspired you in some ways. And we've alluded to this before, but Colin McCann, a New Zealand modernist, is one of those artists that has inspired you. And recently you had an exhibition at the Dowse Museum in New Zealand where your works were presented alongside Colin McCann. For people who don't know, why is Colin McCann so important to you?
I discovered Colin McCann's work in the same way I discovered many artists' work when I was an art student. So it was just in a stack of books with Louise Bourgeois, Picasso, all these other artists. So I didn't really understand that he was from New Zealand and local, really. That context wasn't meaningful at that time. So I just thought he was a great artist. And I really loved that his words took up human scale. And so that you could have letters, I am, as big as a human. And that really resonated for me. And that he had transitioned from making works with a lot of symbols to works with words because he had to say what he meant. And so often in my work, I'm trying to say what I mean.
This use of text in your work is one motif amongst a number of motifs that you work with. But let's talk about some of these motifs that have been centralised or featured in your practice, which is 25 years. Do you have a number now? How long have you been making art for?
30, I reckon.
30 years. It's so interesting how these numbers start to have a meaning. I've been saying 10 years lately. but let's talk about some of these motifs. Smiley faces, eggs, teardrops, lightning bolts. But one that I'm really interested in is the ghost. It's this simplified cartoon-like form ghost. What is it about this motif that has kind of captivated you over the years?
It's interesting because so many of these symbols I was using pre-emoji, which is why we love emoji so much, because their simplicity cuts through. And the ghost came about because I was doing psychotherapy and trying to understand or become intimate with my own ghosts. And I thought about how I could make them both friendly and a little bit scary. And so they've just become this beautiful vehicle for me to say pretty much anything. It's like Miffy. You can't really see if Miffy's happy or sad. Yeah. It's what you're feeling that you project onto Miffy. And so just when you see the ghosts all together, they look like they could be a choir singing this beautiful song, or they could be screaming the pain and suffering of the whole world. And I just love that they literally hover between these two. They're spectral, you know. And when I saw glass being blown for the first time, that was the lightning bolt moment that I'm going to make glass ghosts. And that was just the perfect material with this idea that had been circulating around. And I look at a lot of children's drawings and the purity of them. I love hopscotch ghosts. Yeah, just, again, that's staying with the curiosity and simplicity of a childlike mind.
When I look at those ghosts, it's almost this invitation of not knowing how to respond, but liking that not knowing. You know, so it's not a discomfort in how am I meant to engage with these. It's almost like this friendly but somewhat alarming image, which I think is quite comfortable, because I just think that's the way we move through the world a lot of the time, navigating risk in some capacity.
Exactly. And that's what we all love about art. We love the familiar with the unfamiliar and the something that's really mysterious but seems really essential. And we love contradiction because we are a contradiction, and we want to see that contradiction externalized somehow.
If we were to walk into your studio, what does it feel like? If you're not working with one material, if you're working with a bunch of things, what would we as a viewer encounter if we were walking into your studio space?
Well, when you work with lots of materials, you need space. That's one thing that you learn pretty quickly. So walking into my studio, I love having different workstations set up. So I've got an air drying clay section next to the sink, and I do like to have my materials quite organized. So I have clean sections and dirty sections. Making the quilt for so long meant that I had to be very clean for a long time.
Why was that? Why did you have to be clean when you were making the quilt?
I had to be clean when making the quilt because I felt such a huge responsibility of honoring and looking after these gifts, and that I made sure they didn't get mold or anything like that, or dust from my other work. So yeah, I really felt like a mother hen on a nest that had to keep an eye on them at all times. So a lot of the dirtiest work I do outside the studio, and work at, you know, Canberra Glassworks or Everly Works at the blacksmith workshop.
And what are you wearing?
What am I wearing right now?
In the studio.
Well, right now, and I have to tell you what I'm wearing right now. I'm wearing my bananas and pajamas t-shirt. In the studio, I love to wear old clothes, actually, really, really old clothes. It's actually like a uniform, you know, that it's a studio ritual to walk in and change. That's also years of getting good clothes damaged or, you know, sitting in paint. But there are certain studio strategies which long-term artists always employ. So you put the same shirt on you had on yesterday, you listen to the same song so you can go into that same space.
Nell, it has been an absolute pleasure hearing about everything that you're doing and making. If you were to end with a sentence, why is it that you make art?
I don't know.
You know what, Nell? Same.
And I love that we don't know.
I don't know either.
Let's keep doing it. Let's keep not knowing.
Nell there, speaking with Ramesh Marionithyendran. And you can check out The Big Hose. It's a giant permanent public work by Nell and Tony Albert at the Gallery of Modern Art, or GOMA, in Brisbane. And you can see Face Everything, a 30-year survey of Nell's work, which is on until the 8th of March at the Heidi Museum in Melbourne. You're listening to The Art Show on Radio National. I'm Sky Kirkham, bringing you some of my favourite highlights from the program. Climate change and rising temperatures are changing and reshaping landscapes around the world, and increasingly, artists have been documenting the impacts of climate change in their homelands. More than two decades ago, the Icelandic artist Oliver Eliasson hired a small Cessna plane to fly across Iceland so that he could capture and document the epic glaciers and glacial rivers. When he returned years later, many of those glaciers were completely unrecognizable or had disappeared. The Art Show's Rosa Ellen caught up with Oliver and began by asking him what it was like taking that first flight more than 25 years ago to capture the glaciers of his homeland.
Well, the southern coast on Iceland is an area where I've spent a lot of time because my father lived there. So I, to some extent, grew up there. I lived in Denmark and spent my summers in Iceland. And I always hiked a lot, also across the glaciers. So I've had a relatively familiar, should I say, relationship with them. And obviously, one can do photos on the glacier and one can somehow have a physical relationship, but it's really hard to actually see the glacier until you get up into a plane. And I guess I was just out of art school. I took all my money and I rented this tiny little Cessna one propeller plane with a pilot, and I was hanging out the window with my camera, so dangling over the glaciers. And I shot all the glacier tongues on the sort of southern area of Iceland, about 45 of them. And in that sense, I could sort of document from a bird perspective, you could say, how incredible and amazing and, you know, colorful the landscape with the glaciers and the glacier rivers and so on and so forth. So it was really my sort of excitement about nature, and maybe also in particular about how nature is constantly changing and on flux, and, you know, seasons and weather and wind and all of that. So I, for many summers over the years, did photo documentations of various phenomena in Iceland, and the glaciers were one of the big photo documentations I did.
And what was driving that first trip? Was it that you just wanted to experience it from a bird's eye view, something that you knew so well on the ground?
At the time, I was really interested in the sheer beauty of the nature in Iceland. I was interested in the sort of the idea of the Arctic and how Arctic landscapes were so different and so unusual, to a large extent, maybe even like lunar. It was like so different. You couldn't, you know, you could sort of stand on a glacier or on a landscape in Iceland, and it was just like being on the moon. It was like there was no indication of scale. There was no, you know, there's no house, there's no car, there's no road, there's no, you know, no animals and anything. You just look at the thing in front of you, go, what am I looking at? What is this? And it is so alienating that you also start to doubt, well, is it even real, or am I even real, or do I even exist, and so on. So I thought it was a sort of a lovely opportunity for me to reflect on more kind of fundamental or existential, which is maybe a little too much, but, you know, it was sort of sketching for me as an artist. And I brought the photos back to my studio, where I worked with recreating natural phenomena often as a work of art. And I did projects where I used, should I say, the ephemera that I knew from Iceland and other places, in all fairness, and I used that in my work. So it was like kind of like a sketchbook. And taking aerial photographs was also just like adding a perspective of, you know, things that were invisible, like when you're walking on the glacier, and try to make sort of the invisible visible. And I was interested in maps and cartography and, you know, the sort of whole history of aerial photography and the relationship with land is also very exciting and interesting. So it was not an unusual thing for me to jump into the plane at the time.
And you went back in 2019. What had changed?
Interestingly, I knew, and everyone knows, that the landscapes are changing, not just the glaciers, but actually the flora and the fauna, and things are just gradually shifting as Iceland is, as most other countries, also going through environmental changes. And I had mapped, preparing for going back photographing, I had mapped the glaciers. I had found a geologist in Iceland who knew where, you know, a glaciologist, to be honest, where is what glacier and how, what would they be called? And I was trying to sort of calculate what was the relative height of the plane at the time. So I was well prepared. And flying along the south coast again, I realized when looking out the window that, no, I had not prepared well enough. This is not the glacier I was looking for. I leaned over to the pilot and showed the photo on my lap and said, this is the glacier we need to photograph. Why is it not here? And the guy pointed out the window and said, this is it. This is it. Look at the mountaintops there. And he was right. I could see the mountains were still there, but the glacier had simply, it was simply so different. I thought it would be, okay, it's going to just be a little bit smaller, but it was a completely different. And I was so shocked and mortified, because what obviously became apparent is that suddenly I was presented with seeing what was absent. So it's not like, okay, here's glacier A, here's glacier B. I was seeing the difference between glacier A and B, the 20 years difference. So it was the presence of absence that was the most shocking part of it.
How did it feel to see that absence?
Well, it's hard to describe, because I also don't think we should somehow over-romanticize the emotional aspects of it. But I think there's a saying that in, I believe it's in 1942, a Jewish person who escaped the Second World War went from Germany to America, and he stands in front of the judge saying, what is going on in Germany? Right? And the judge leans over and say, I can hear what you're saying, and I can see you're telling the truth, but I cannot believe what you're saying. So it's interesting that between what we know being the truth to actually believing, there's still a tiny little gap. So in that moment where I was sitting and watching the glacier, I know what I was about to see, because it's not a secret that they are smaller, but it went from being something that was the truth to something that I believed. And interestingly, that's a little sort of quantum leap. Like suddenly I physically had the proof of what I knew was being truth in my brain or in my mind, what I had read in the papers, in the books, in the science reports, in the data-driven sort of protocols, and suddenly it went into my body to become something that I believed in. And that is, I think, the difference.
How did that sort of then understanding of the truth, you know, impact what you made of that journey, which was a photo exhibition, a series of comparative photographs of the glacier?
No, so I was obviously quite intrigued of sort of using the old photos again, that which was in fact an old work of art. Then I took those and I framed them side by side with the old and the new photos. And it was fun to also make it, frankly speaking, to fly around and try to find the same spot with a tiny little same airplane. And in that sense, I made a new work of art, which is, you could say, the before and after photos, right? So 35 photos in a very large grid on the wall or sort of hanging around in a line, depending on how you want to do it, and then or hang it. And then you stand and looking at it, and people go like, oh. And again, what I think works particularly well, it makes the invisible visible. It makes the, you know, the what you see is what is not there. It's not like you see, okay, glacier, beautiful glacier, and it is still quite beautiful the way it is today, even though it's a lot smaller, but you obviously see what is not there, the difference between the two. And that is what makes it, I think, so compelling.
Your work is sort of known for its scale and ingenuity, like waterfalls. You created a fake sun at the Tate Modern. But this is a straight photograph series. It seems like a rather simple concept. Why did you go for the documentation rather than some concept-driven piece of art?
No, photo documentation is things that I've worked with for many years now. I've documented plants, I've documented small rivers, hot springs, small pieces of ice in the ocean, pieces of ice in rivers. I've sailed in sort of river rafted down all the rivers, documenting the river from the perspective of the river going through the canyons. I've flown over the rivers, the same rivers from the air. I've documented a river before it was dammed, again after it was dammed. So it was like I've created this sort of a logbook of, should I say, the natural phenomena as seen through the lens of a camera And all these photos, they form a kind of a body of work that is incredibly important for me as a sort of source of inspiration, but also as a kind of frame of reference out of which a lot of my other works have grown. And for people who maybe are looking at the sun, as you mentioned, or waterfalls, or the rainbow piece I've done, and so on and so forth, I think it's interesting, or it's an opportunity at least for people to actually go further into the work and see some of this science or sketching that lays in all these photographic documentations.
Seems like Icelandic people have a really emotional reaction and to these glaciers melting, and sort of mourning and grief for these vanishing glaciers. That's an understandable sentiment. But is it kind of galvanizing? Like, how important is optimism?
Well, you said that Icelanders, they have a particular relationship with the glaciers. I think every people around the world, indigenous or not, have a relationship with the sort of unique nature of the environments in which they are. I think the Australians are incredibly affected about the horrible wildfires there is now. Now people actually physically re-experience the intimacy and the respect they have for their country that they love so much. So in Iceland, it's not different. When people see suddenly not just one, but over the next 50 years, a lot of glaciers are going to be declared as not glacier anymore. And in that sense, of course, there is a... I wouldn't say one should compare as easily, but there is a similarity. Suddenly, there is not that glacier anymore, that maybe some Icelanders as a child remember that glacier very vividly because it was a big white thing on the horizon, right? So in this case, an Icelandic author, Andri Snær, who's also an amazing environmentalist and a great person in articulating with or sculpting with words the consciousness around what is the environmental challenge also about. And together with some scientists from Rice University in St. Louis, they created a sort of a event, you could say, a funeral, and they had politicians, environmentalists. There was the Kumi Naidu, the sort of the leader of Amnesty International, the amazing environmentalist Mary Robinson, the former president of Ireland, was there. So there was this sort of gathering of people, both locally and internationally, to sort of make also out of the event the sort of make it a fact that the things are changing. What I thought was particularly touching about the event was in fact that there was a little plaque, or you know, a little sign on a rock where the glacier had been, where it says this glacier has now been declared thing. It's like a little bit like a tombstone or like a stone on a graveyard, right? So, but on that plaque it says, we know why this is happening, we know what to do also about it, and only you in the future, I mean, so only you who will come and see this plaque maybe in 20 years will know whether we did it. So it's an interesting sort of testimony for, let's just imagine, and this is where I think it became so emotional, let's imagine 20 years from now, or 50 years from now, it's really not that long time, right? Or grandchildren's children, let's imagine that they look back at us today and they ask us, well, you knew it, right? You knew it all. Why? What did you do? Why did you not react differently than you did? Considering that in 100 years from now, in 50 years from now, we are probably going to have much more severe things than the fires that we have in Australia now to deal with.
Oliver Eliasson there, speaking with Rosa Ellen back in 2020 as fires were sweeping through Australia. And I wanted to bring you that because the Gallery of Modern Art, or GOMA, in Brisbane is presenting a significant collection of Eliasson's work this summer. It's titled Presence, and it's taking over the ground floor of the gallery, bringing together major early works and site-specific installations, from a rainbow suspended in a veil of mist to a huge Lego city and, of course, his landscape photography. It's running until the 12th of July. You're listening to The Art Show on Radio National. I'm Sky Kirkham, bringing you some of my favourite highlights from the program. And we're ending the show today with Mike Hewson, an artist who really knows what it means to bring a sense of play to his work. One of his installations is actually just down the road from the studio here in Melbourne. It's a sculpture of sorts, giant rocks and pipes that look delicately balanced, almost ready to fall over. But it's also a playground, an actual playground. And when you walk past, there are always kids climbing over it, figuring out how to use it. It's a long way from the pristine, hands-off approach of a typical gallery. But that's how Mike approaches his art. His latest exhibition, The Keys Under the Mat, at the Art Gallery of New South Wales, is a sauna, a public barbecue, a playground. It's art as a public square, art that invites you in. And last year, Mike sat down with Ramesh Marionithyendran to explore his own practice.
Have you ever walked into a gallery and felt unsure about what the art actually is? I can recall so many occasions where I've stepped through the door and I haven't known whether the air conditioner vent next to the marble sculpture is actually part of the exhibition or not. But that is one of my favourite things about contemporary art. Contemporary art is about ideas. It's about minds. It's about materials. Mike Hewson has built a career out of the unexpected. He's taken art out of the galleries and onto the streets, suspending palm trees from the lampposts of Wollongong and shaping giant rocks into a playground in Melbourne. Mike, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, something that I would absolutely hate is the idea of people touching or crawling over my artworks. Like, that would send me into some kind of head spin. But you've made heaps of playgrounds. You know, for you, that's part of the point, right?
Yeah, I guess I haven't really had the luxury of stopping people from that. You know, as soon as you start making things in public space, you can't tell them, don't do that. So I guess, yeah, that's been the start of how I've been, you know, going on the journey of, it's almost become something where it's like the generous way to like let someone engage is like, I'm not going to stop you, do your best.
It's interesting you say engage, because you really invite a very specific type of engagement. And something that you've often spoken about is risk. Why does risk matter? And specifically in the context of what you do, why does risk matter?
I mean, I think it's something that just kind of rolled out of all of the other things I've been thinking about. I mean, my first public project, if I wind back a little bit further, all of my projects were temporary. So they were just basically like paste-ups on buildings. And it was in Christchurch where we just had this big earthquake and all the buildings were being knocked down. So I had no way of being precious about what would happen to the artwork. I would put it up on the building get knocked down. So I wasn't able to sort of slow people down from interacting with it, nor did I really care. And then so when I went to do my first permanent public artwork, there was actually a playground in that space that had been ripped down. I was like, well, why don't I just do it like a playground to replace that one? But I was more thinking about sculpture. And then kind of turns out it's like this quite amazing kind of format for making artwork.
When you transitioned from going from these temporary paste-ups, you know, in Christchurch, to your first permanent work, how did that feel for you and how did you manage that proposition?
Well, I had worked as an engineer in like marine construction, so I'd built things before, but I never, you know, thought of them as artworks. So I thought that I had the skill set that would translate into things that were permanent. And I slowly kind of stepped through that in that first project in Wollongong. And I guess out of that has flown all these conversations around risk, because I was sort of putting together these sculptures, as I'm calling them, that kind of feel like they're maybe like were just put there or temporary or kind of half falling apart, maybe teetering a little bit. And I guess it came sort of maybe back to that disruption earlier in Christchurch with the earthquake, where everything sort of did fall down. So I didn't really feel like anything should feel that sort of permanent. And then I guess the risk part just, yeah, I also get quite pissed off at what you see in the public realm as not being particularly interesting. And I guess designers are kind of, you know, they draw and plan some sort of curvy lines and extrude them up and you sort of almost feel like you're in a rendering of some sort of proposal. So I was just really wanting to kind of, you know, artists love materials that have like some kind of energy or life force in them. So if you could sort of bring that energy to public space in the format of like landscape architecture or built environment, then maybe you're doing something interesting.
something that you've kind of done a few times is we kind of pause. Well, I've done this too. You know, as soon as we say sculpture, there's this kind of pause or this grin. And, you know, what I'm really interested in unpacking, especially with you, is this idea that, you know, what can art actually be in public space and what are our public spaces here for? You know, something that I often resonate with as well is this, you know, often, you know, approaches to town planning or civic infrastructure is incredibly conservative, but you're actually inviting some kind of discussion. You know, parents unleash their children into these spaces and they actually have to work out how to approach this kind of equipment. And what I'm really asking you is there some kind of political dimension to your approach to making art?
I mean, I'm not that clever to be making those sorts of things, but I guess, you know, ideology is baked into everything. And so, you know, playgrounds, for example, if you look at how they're designed, they do reflect society's values on how they sort of see, you know, how parents should behave, how kids should behave, what's an appropriate level of risk. And so, you know, as an artist, you feel like that's stuff you can play with. And I think when you're thinking about, you know, making, you know, thinking about the future of a young child, you know, it would be great to kind of make them feel powerful. And if you can kind of give them, expose them to these opportunities where they can kind of challenge themselves and kind of climb to the top of a mini mountain, albeit a rock, I think that's like a kind of a really great thing to do. And yeah, I mean, it came back to me just wanting to find excuses or more ways of funding doing sculpture. Like, the public hates spending money on artwork. I mean, you know, it's something that you just get dragged through the coals. It's always going to be like that. And it was more of an afterthought, but I realized after doing the first playground, I was like, well, no one's actually giving me grief about this part of the project. They almost kind of ignore it. I was like, if I can find ways to kind of sneak these projects in, like basically, can I have the landscape architect's budget and the builder's budget and the whoever else is kind of involved in the design process and just package that all together and deliver on some like functional outcome, then I'm actually not competing with any other artists either. So that was sort of a bit of an experiment. But it turned out that as soon as you start making these projects that look like they're half falling over, but kids really love them and they confront parents, I ended up, you know, doing all this public speaking around risk, and it wasn't really what I was trying to do, but I think it really galvanized as a few more of these projects have emerged that people are really interested in this. And designers are like, oh, thank you so much. Like, you know, when like a developer or someone or a council tells me you can't do something, I just show them a photo of your stuff. And so it's these kind of prompts to kind of like, I guess, push against those kind of bureaucratic and like managerial power that often wants to restrict people, particularly designers, because they are trying to do interesting things. They're just often limited by all the processes that they have to go through. I mean, one of the great things that artists can do is like we get commissioned to do an artwork. It's not like, you know, we do a design and then we submit it for consideration and then get, you know, like if you're designing public space, you have to do a drawing, it goes to council and they cost it and then they send it to a builder. And all of that process dilutes the kind of the intensity of the idea. But we're kind of like little rats. We're like, no, like it must be like this. But we can use that to our advantage to kind of really articulate these bit more potent ideas.
It's really fascinating because, you know, I imagine myself in my studio with a ball of clay sometimes, and literally I'm the only person that I'm being held accountable to because it's just me and this, like, you know, lump that I can form. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it sometimes takes me back to being a child where I just loved playing with materials. And I think, gosh, I wish I could, like, get that freedom back, which is a cliche that we all kind of think about and talk about. But, you know, what were you like as a kid? What kind of mountains were you making to climb over by yourself? I know this is a slightly Freudian approach to understanding what you do.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a little country school, sort of, on a little farm. So we were able to sort of wander over the hills for, you know, go hunting and make tree houses. So I guess there weren't many limits on or any really monitoring of what we were sort of doing. So I feel like there was a lot of sort of free thinking. My grandmother was an artist, and I think there was something about her life that as a kid, I was sort of curious about these kind of paintings on the walls and things that drew me in. I ended up going to engineering school. I sort of left art, but then that kind of curiosity grabbed me back in my 20s, and then I did go to art school, did a master's.
To lots of people, if you think about the word civil engineering or the concept of civil engineering, and then you think about concepts of contemporary art, we could see them as somewhat opposed. And what's your approach? Why did you go from being a civil engineer or training in civil engineering to working kind of broadly in this speculative, imaginative space of art where really anything is possible?
Yeah, I think at a younger age, like 18, I was just scared of the uncertainty of art. Like it is, it's kind of, you know, you're sort of staring into the abyss a little bit. Like you're really confronting some big questions around the world and what's important, what's true. And I think my younger mind was like, give me some structure. And, you know, so I went through that phase, and then, you know, later I used to kind of hide the fact that I was a engineer, like amongst the artists anyway, because, you know, I haven't done my time doing my undergrad. And I guess it wasn't actually until I got to the States where they were like, oh, that's great that you don't have you don't have all the baggage and you're making kind of interesting work. So yeah, come and have a seat at the table. I was like, are you sure? Like, you know, I did my engineering degree, right? But then I kind of figured out, I guess through that engineering just kind of sort of problem solving in a very logical way. And artists, I think we create these sort of abstract problems that we're trying to solve. It might be just trying to deal with, you know, some sort of history, symbols, narrative, and we're trying to like solve this problem that's really kind of, you know, unavailable to anyone else to see why we're trying to do that or how we're doing it. But the end result is something, when you see really good artwork, it kind of just like hits you in the face.
Let's talk about this public space. Everybody has an opinion. You know, as an artist, I feel like sometimes we put our artworks in these gallery spaces and there are these walls which become symbolic walls. But as soon as we stick our artworks in the public, there's almost this sense of communal ownership where it feels like everybody has an opinion. How have you handled these very public responses and consumptions of your artworks?
Well, I guess I do believe that it is the public space. So I don't feel like I have any ownership over it. I mean, I think as artists, we, you know, we develop these sort of moral rights agreements around, you know, if we do get commissioned to do an artwork, they can't sort of modify it and repaint it and decide they want to add a bit. But other than that, like I don't feel like, you know, so I sort of present things and go, well, it's yours now. Like, yeah, you deal with it as you will. But I mean, I also think, and you know, it started from my first project. I thought that its long-term life will be the test of the thing. You know, say this, again, going back to the palm tree work, because that's gotten me the most heat. Every project I've sort of ended up on a current affair or and sort of dragged through Twitter. But that project continues to kind of have this strong reaction, which I haven't fully understood until more recently. A lot of it came down to misunderstanding money, for example. Like people thought that like one small part of the project costed a certain amount of money, and that really sort of gets under their skin. But I think I also didn't explain enough about how complex it was to deliver this project, because I hide all of my tricks. So it just looks like I literally just dragged a palm tree down, quickly scurried up the pole, truck strapped it up, and then, you know, if you read some of the things, it's like he's just scurried off back to New York with all the money. You know, which is like, for me, it's really, that's the part that hurts when I know, like, you know, I sort of went into debt finishing that project and took me a couple of years and really burnt me out. So I think those things I find hard, but you also can't hold it against the public because it is their space and they do get to decide. And I think I've just been trying in future projects to give more, to reveal more, and to be less precious about kind of what the reaction is.
And when you're making these things, you also have to consider long-term impact. What goes into the planning of keeping these things safe and repairable?
Well, I guess, yeah, again, just thinking about the kind of the potential legacy. I can't assume that people are going to want it there in 10, 50 years, 100 years. But you try and do a good enough project that you're really happy with, that it might be there for a long time. And then just stepping through all the materials and all the kind of maintenance requirements, the code requirements, to basically make sure it's unlikely to be a risk to the public, it's easy to maintain, you know, and then you give it the potential to kind of have that legacy. So with back to the Wollongong project with the palm trees, the idea is that they will just continue to grow for 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And I think hopefully at that point, the small child that remembers growing up there and the trees are in the mall, and then they're a 30-year-old and they're like, wow, those things are really still there. I remember my parents saying those things were going to die after a year. And I think, you know, if you really, and also the materials get better with time. I mean, that's another thing that public art really disappoints on often, is it just like, after a while, it's just like, wow, that's not looking sharp. So I think, you know, the material thing is really important for me. Like, does it get better? You know, when you come up close to it, does it give you more? And if you can do that, I think, you know, as artists, we love that stuff. We're like, you know.
I'm going to ask you a cheeky question, Mark. I hope you're prepared.
No surprises.
I imagine bringing your concepts to these kinds of panels, you have to do a lot of convincing.
Yeah.
What are some of your strategies to convince these people?
Well, I think the engineer ticket's been a good one, you know? They do trust you. But I mean, you know, some of the projects, say my first one with Inner West Council, they didn't want anything to do with me. It was commissioned through a public art process. I said, I want to demolish, rather than do a playable sculpture next to the existing sad playground, I said, the artwork needs to be the playground. So I want to demolish that and fully replace it with these fences, which were effectively like ghost fences, like remaking the front fences of homes that the government had taken over the last 30 years in that area. And so the council just didn't, they were like, don't sign anything, don't agree to anything, nothing. I just had to prove myself. And when the playground opened, it won Playground of the Year, it's a good artwork. Then the council were like, on the next project, they sort of just let me go. And so I think I've always realized that you have to earn that. However, you know, there is the other part where, you know, it's the role of the curator to create the space for you. So Barbara Flynn on that Wollongong project, completely mad idea on paper, to kind of, you know, create the space for bureaucrats to agree on what's quite a sort of Dr. Seuss kind of esque proposal, and for them to listen. So there's no way I could have done that without the help of an expert who is really experienced, who carves out that space. But yeah, on each project, I basically just try and prove a little more, push the boundaries a little more. And I know that you have to earn that. That's the only way.
And is boundary pushing something that brings you joy? As an artist, what brings Mike Hewson joy in his studio?
I mean, you know, it's pretty amazing when you see a child kind of light up, or, you know, a kind of grumpy artist, you know, kind of go, it's actually kind of good. But I don't know, just it's the progressive kind of expansion of ideas and kind of, you know, a lot of it's just working with my friends, you know, we sort of, you help each other out on other art projects and you sort of get this community thing happening and you sort of feel like, oh mate, there's something happening in Sydney or Melbourne or whatever. And I think, you know, it's just the everyday that's the goal.
Mike Hewson there, speaking with Ramesh Mario Nithyendran. The Keys Under the Mat, the latest exhibition by Mike, is on now at the Art Gallery of New South Wales. Just remember to bring your swimmers. And that's it for the art show today. Thanks to Rosa Ellen and Ramesh Mario Nithyendran, and to sound engineer Matthew Sigley. I'm Sky Kirkham, and next week you'll meet an Australian artist whose New York exhibition drew so many people that the police shut the whole thing down. That's next week here on The Art Show on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.